Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. Our speaker is Jason F. from the Midtown Group in Bethesda, Maryland.
My name's Jason. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks, Jeff, for asking me to speak. It's an honor and a privilege to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm happy to participate in AA, to participate in my sobriety. My sobriety date is December 21st, 1995. My home group is the Midtown Group in Bethesda, Maryland, and it's a great group. We're a large group, but we're also a very intimate group. Everybody knows everybody, and everybody knows everybody's business too. And sometimes that's a good thing. It helps me to, feel like I'm being held accountable. So we are a big group, but at the same time, we all know and love and care about one another for the most part, and we're welcoming, and very welcoming to the newcomer or to anybody from out of town. And so I always like to put that out there because the group saved my life. But I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And my story is very garden variety, almost pathetic, to be honest with you. I come from a great family. I grew up in a suburb outside of Baltimore in a middle-class to upper-middle-class family. I've never wanted for anything. I have two great parents and an older brother, and later I had a younger brother and sister come along, but I had a couple of older stepbrothers, and just kind of grew up the first couple of years, the first, like, probably from about 6 to 10 or 11 or 12, just kind of grew up looking up to my older brother Dave and my older stepbrothers Ryan and Mike, and we were the troublemakers in the neighborhood when I was growing up. We were the kids that that other parents would warn, stay away from those kids, stay away from those Donley kids or those Friedman kids, they're trouble. And so there may have been other kids in the neighborhood, but we wouldn't have known it. The only time that we ever looked for other kids in the neighborhood was when we convinced ourselves that we were gang members and would get strapped up with baseball bats and chains, and we never actually fought anybody, but we would walk around the neighborhood and act tough and look for other kids to beat up. And of course, I was always the youngest and the smallest, and I was terrified of getting in a fight with anybody, but I would pretend. And so I kind of grew up wanting to be like them. And long before I started drinking, I started stealing, and I loved to steal. I would steal anything I could get my hands on. I was talking to David about it on the way up here. I mean, when I was a kid, I would go into the mall by where I grew up with a book bag, and I would just fill it up with stuff, stuff I didn't even want a lot of the time. Stuff I certainly didn't need, and a lot of times that I didn't even want. And I wasn't stealing necessarily to get whatever I was taking. I was stealing because probably for 5 or 10 minutes after I walked out of the store, I really felt like I got over on somebody, And there was some kind of thrill associated with it. That and the fact that I felt like I could brag about it to my older brother and my stepbrothers. And before I ever started drinking, I remember one time we were causing trouble in the neighborhood, and we went to this grocery store late at night by where I live, and there was this Mercedes-Benz. And at the time, my stepbrothers were listening to, Public Enemy, and Flava Flav had, a Mercedes-Benz, hood ornament on it. He had, a gold chain with a Mercedes-Benz hood ornament. So I had kind of stolen a few of these and sold them to kids in school and stuff. And so I saw this Mercedes-Benz, and, of course, I didn't see the car. I just saw the hood ornament, and I went right for it and started yanking this thing out. But the woman who owned the car came out when I was in the middle of doing this and starts running after me, and she's got that big cart full of groceries, and she's kind of a big lady, so the cart's bouncing and banging, and she's bouncing and running, and I looked up and, figured I could probably outrun her, so I booked and started taking off for these woods. And my stepbrothers and my brother were running as fast as they could. My one stepbrother, Ryan, was on crutches, so he's crutching, as fast as he can, and I'm running. I'm probably 11 years old, 12 years old, and my older brother and my stepbrother are all booking it. And I figured I could outrun this lady, but I didn't know about her son, who was 18, probably a track star, you know. He just started running after me, yelling, and this, and I'm like a young kid, he's yelling, and this, like, you know, like a man voice, like, get over here, kid, you know, what do you know, stop running, you know, and I was just like, oh my God, this guy's going to kick my ass. Somewhere along the line, it occurred to me, I don't know if this is alcoholic thinking, but it definitely isn't smart. And I was in special ed at this time in my life, so I wasn't the smartest, the sharpest tool in the shed. But I just got this thought, this guy's not going to stop chasing you until he catches you. So you should just stop running. Cause I was like, okay. So I just stopped running, and he took me down and wrestled me to the ground, and I had the cops called, and got arrested, actually, got taken home, and you know, I had to go to this court thing, and I had to do community service, and I guess the reason I tell that story is because I don't really have a criminal record. That's pretty much it. So that's as bad as it got for me, guys. You know, I'm not a tough guy today. I wasn't a tough kid then. I was a flincher. You know what I mean? I was a runner, an avoider. Alcohol did not make me feel tough. It made me feel good. But certainly not tough. I would still run, you know, if that ever came up. But you know, shortly after, you know, we started with the stealing and the breaking windows and the, you know, ripping off hood ornaments. And of course, you know, at that time, you know, I had been to therapists and been to counselors and been to, you know, tutors to help me with my grades because I was always doing poorly in school. Always doing poorly in school. I didn't need alcohol to be a bad student. You know, it didn't matter one way or the other. I was just a bad student, and I had never really excelled in any kind of sports or anything like that. You know, it doesn't necessarily make me an alcoholic, but a lot of people give up things for alcohol. And in my story, I didn't give up anything. You know, my life was a blank canvas when I started drinking. I had nothing going on at all. And so my parents had tried to funnel me through these normal channels that kids go to, you know, like sports and Sunday school, and I went to all that stuff, you know. And I was given every opportunity, and from an early age, you know, long before I started hanging out with my older brother and my stepbrothers, everyone was trying to wonder and figure out and kind of answer this problem, what's wrong with Jason? You know, what is wrong with you? And people would ask me all the time, why did you do that, you know, and before I ever took a drink. And I never had an answer for them, you know. But what I can tell you is that, you know, Sunday school didn't work for me. You know, I threw the book at the teacher, you know. They don't like that when you do that. He actually threatened to hit me. You know, therapy never worked for me. I'm an alcoholic. My problem is self-centeredness. So thinking about myself more, talking about myself more isn't going to help me. It's not going to solve my problem. And you know, I was put into all these special ed classes, and that never helped me. I was put on different medication initially to help me concentrate in school, but later for things like depression. And then I actually got put on this medication I never needed for headaches because I used to say I had headaches so I could go to sleep in the nurse's office, and I never had headaches at that age. Ironically, from 18 to 30, I've gotten like 3 headaches a week for the last 12 years of my life. So I don't know if that's payback for my higher power or what, but nothing worked for me. And I had always suffered from this sense of being different from other people. I had this sense of separation between me and everybody else. I was intensely uncomfortable in social situations, and it wasn't like, I don't mean in school. I felt just as uncomfortable around my own family, around people that I knew loved me. And I felt uncomfortable around everyone. If I was hanging out by myself, I usually felt uncomfortable. So it wasn't like an outside circumstance. There was something inside of me that was broken. And I think a lot of people have some kind of malady. You know, the big book says that we're maladjusted to life, and I think that's true. That doesn't necessarily make me an alcoholic. I think what makes me an alcoholic more than anything is one afternoon I was hanging out with, you know, my best friend Dave Goldstein and this guy Evan who was crazy enough to buy booze for a bunch of underage kids, and he bought us these quarts of King Cobra malt liquor, which was 99¢ for a quart, and I remember it tasted awful, you know, and I remember trying drinking and never really liking the taste of alcohol, but I was really working at it this time, and I got probably halfway to three quarters of the way down this quart of King Cobra malt liquor, and somewhere towards around the halfway to three quarter mark of that bottle, all of a sudden I realized why people drank this stuff, you know. And I felt like, I thought, I can't believe this only costs 99 cents. No, this is definitely worth $1.04, you know. And and I soon upgraded to Mickey's, which was just as putrid, but it cost more like $1.10. So I, you know, I was moving up. And what alcohol did for me was it erased that invisible line between me and you, and allowed me to come out and play, you know. And some people say I thought I was funnier when I was drinking. I really was funnier when I was drinking, because I wasn't so self-conscious. I wasn't so nervous. I wasn't so obsessed with what other people thought about me. I felt, and I could have never worded it this way at the time, but in sobriety and in hindsight and looking over my life, I know what it was. I felt the way that I thought everyone else felt all the time. I assumed that everyone else was comfortable and I was the weird one, and maybe they weren't, you know, but all I thought about was how awful I felt all the time, and I had no explanation for it, and no one could do anything for me. But all of a sudden I found this stuff where if I drank a quart or a half a pint or a pint of bourbon, I just felt good, really good, you know. And that's what alcohol does for someone like me, for an alcoholic, you know. It doesn't do that for everybody. There are a lot of people out there that like to drink, that like to get drunk. They probably feel a little loose. They probably get something out of it. But for me, there was such an inadequacy from the get-go that once I poured alcohol into it, you know, I was off to the races. And, you know, a friend of mine said, alcohol gave me the satisfaction of a job well done without having to do a goddamn thing. And I couldn't, and as a young alcoholic, you really couldn't ask for much more than that, you know. And that's why I loved it, because I had never wanted to put the work in. I had never, you know, people talked to me about responsibility from, you know, 6 years old, and I was never interested, you know. And so, of course, what happened with my life was it started to go downhill, you know. In school, my grades went from very bad to even worse than that. I went from kind of being in classes with kids that were mentally challenged, and so I would do okay because I'm relatively intelligent, to doing worse than them. You know, in most of my class, I went from showing up to school and kind of like drearily going through my day to not showing up to school, to cutting classes, to run and get drunk or high with my friends, and in the beginning of my drinking, you know, I had a lot of fun. I had a great time, actually. I wouldn't be in AA if it was miserable from the start, because it wasn't, you know. For me, in the beginning, it was a lot about what alcohol did for me that I recognized as being alcoholic. You know, I'd sneak out of my house in the middle of the night and probably, you know, midnight, once my parents went to bed, and I'd meet up with my friend Evan or my friend Dave, and somebody would have gotten the booze, and so we'd have our bourbon or we'd have our beer, and, you know, we'd start drinking, and I'd get that effect that alcohol gave me, and I'd start to feel loose and comfortable and good, and then I'd kind of usually, oftentimes I'd overshoot the mark and I'd drink a little too much and, you know, maybe end up puking all over the place or so. You know, I mean, just regular, fun, young, drunk stuff. And then stumbling home, and usually I'd leave my window open a crack, so I'd kind of like be like kind of not really seeing straight, a little blurry, but trying to just make sure that I could still get back into my house. And I'd sneak back in the middle of the night, and, you know, maybe I usually had Saturday school detention. My whole life I was, a screw-up, so I always was in detention. And so my mom would bang on my door an hour later, and I'd be, like, drunk and tripping on acid, you know, going to Saturday school. And, and so that's kind of what it was like. It was, you know, fun for an alcoholic. Maybe not, I mean, you know, I'm sure that, you know, the kids that were in the advanced placement program wouldn't consider that fun, but that's what I did for fun, you know. And I don't have a lot of, like, I can't talk to you about beer pong. I've never played that, you know. I can't talk to you about keg stands or going to, you know, I never went to a party in high school. I was not invited. You know what I'm saying? I was not, I can't talk to you about, like, dating a cheerleader and, you know, having a red cup at some fraternity party, you know what I mean? That never happened for me, ever, you know. I went to one college party in my drinking, and it wasn't a party. It was just I knew somebody that was in college, and they were a loser just like I was, so that we weren't getting invited anywhere. And and so that's kind of what my drinking was like, and it was a lot of fun, you know. I didn't need a party because the party was in the bottle, you know, or the party was in the pipe or whatever we were doing. And you know, I try not to talk about drugs too much. Drugs are a big part of my story. You know, I wasn't out there discriminating, thinking about my primary purpose when I was drinking and getting high. I was just doing every single thing I could get my grubby little hands on. And but I do try. I do recognize that this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and so, you know, when I tell my story, I try to confine my discussion there. But I will say that I did everything that I came across with no questions asked. I did everything that I ever heard of. I did things that I didn't know what they were. And not everything gave me that sense of release and ease and comfort that alcohol gave me. But that didn't stop me from trying it three or four times, you know, or five. But I definitely got that from alcohol and from, you know, a handful of other stuff. And you know, and I had a great time out there. But what happened was, what happened to probably everyone in this room, which is that drinking and the lifestyle I was living and the things that I was doing and the people that I was hanging out with started to bring consequences into my life, negative consequences. Now, I'd always been a troublemaker, like I said. I'd always been kind of disapproved of by my family. But all of a sudden, I started to pay more consequences, and I started to suffer from tremendous guilt. It usually had to do with stealing money from my mom, because I would take money out of her purse. Every drink I ever took was out of my mom's purse. You know, I'd steal $5 here or $10 there, and I'd run out and I'd go party with my friends for, you know, for a night, and I'd come back home, and, you know, but that turned into $20, you know. And it turned from once every week or two to several times a week. And then every time I was sober, I couldn't stand being sober, you know. And I'd pace the floor of my house waiting for my mom to get home, waiting for my mom's purse to get home. Or I'd tear the house apart looking for where she hid the money. And so she started to hide money from me all over the house, you know. And it became like a game of cat and mouse. You know, where'd she put it this time? Where's her purse this time? And, you know, she'd be in one room. I'd be in the next room rifling through her stuff, you know, getting that same sense of excitement or anxiety, you know. And then I'd run out of the house, and it went from kind of sneaking out in the middle of the night or going out and saying I was going one place but going out and getting drunk somewhere else, you know. And in the beginning, I'd pay consequences. Like, I'd go out with my buddies, and I'd get drunk, and I'd find a nice soft patch of grass and decide to take a nap. I was passing out, but I would just say, this is a nice place to take a nap, you know what I mean? And I'd just pass out, and I'd wake up, and there'd be, like, leaves stuck to my face and you know, like, grass imprints all over, and I'm, like, still half drunk, and of course, my friends had left me, and, you know, I had to walk home a couple miles. Consequences like that, too. I'd go out with my friends, and I'd go from sneaking out to just walking out, you know. So looking at my mom in the eye and saying, you know, F you, you're a bop bop, you know, and I would just, you know, cuss her out, try and make her feel guilty because I had $100 of her money in my back pocket and I didn't want her to know about it. And I'd want her to think that I was angry and rageful, and that's why I was storming out of the house, because of how horribly I'd been treated in my suburban home, you know. But really I was running out and guilt tripping her because I couldn't stand the way I felt when I was sober. I couldn't stand the way I felt when I was sober, and I had to leave, you know. And I remember one time I took some money, and I probably cussed her out or just ran out. And you know, a lot of people come to AA and they talk about that feeling like it was everyone else. And I have to say, I never felt that way. I didn't feel like a victim, like it was everyone else's fault, and that's why I drank or that's why I did the things I did. I always knew it was me, always, you know. And once I'd get loaded, I'd be filled with that sense of guilt, you know. I would act like it was you, but I knew. I wasn't even kidding myself. I knew it was me. And so, you know, I mean, I remember one time I ran out of the house and you know, my mom's combing the streets looking for me, you know, driving up and down. She knew where my friends lived, a few of my friends, because she had dropped me off there from time to time. And she's, you know, combing the streets looking for me. She finds me, and of course I book it and start running. And just like that 18-year-old kid, my mom is faster than me, you know. And she chases me down in the middle of the street, and I stop running, and she starts wrestling with me. you know. And I remember I had probably $20 or $40 of her money, and she didn't even look at me. She just started screaming, "I just want the money. You can do whatever you want. I just want the money you took from me," you know. And it's not like I come from an unloving home, but they had given up on me, you know. And that's what I do to my family, you know. And that's the kind of person I was when I was out there. I'd run out of the house for a couple of days, and I'd come back home when I would get hungry, strung out, crazy, you know. My friends certainly weren't putting up with me, you know, once I ran out of money. And so, you know, they'd drop me off, and I'd walk back up to the front door and knock, and sometimes they'd let me in to sleep it off, and sometimes my stepfather would open the door, depending on how much money I'd taken, and throw a quarter at me and say, "Go call your father, you don't live here anymore," you know. And then I'd go and live with my dad until I could manipulate my way back into my mom's house, because it was easier to drink and get high around her, you know. She didn't have such a tight leash on me. Around my dad, if he'd look at me, I would just get terrified, you know. And there was no kind of physical abuse or anything like that. It was just I always had this sense of reverence for my father. I can't explain it. But what I will tell you is that didn't straighten me out in any way. In fact, what it did was it made me ignore him basically entirely for the 3 years that I was out there drinking and using. And the reason that I ignored him was because I couldn't get over on him. And if there was one person in my life that I couldn't get over on, that was a person I was avoiding, like the plague. I wasn't going to talk to him. And so, of course, I'm basically failing out of school, which is the only real measure of success that had been placed upon me at that time. I had no extra. I had never had any extracurricular activities. I had nothing going on. I was just, you know, living that life of, you know, desperation and loneliness, and killing my family, you know. And yet, every time I'd run out, I would. And get loaded, I would just get filled with that sense of guilt and shame for doing the things that I was doing. And sometimes I'd call him up and tell him about it, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning from some payphone in some disgusting club bathroom, you know, in the middle of downtown Baltimore, you know. Or sometimes I'd wake up in one of those clubs in downtown Baltimore and my ride had left, you know. So I'd have to call my old man to pick me up in the middle of some alley in downtown Baltimore. That was a good night, let me assure you. And so one night, my dad came over to the house to give me some money. I remember taking this money from him, and he just wrestled me to the ground, and he smacked me in the face, and he said, "What are you doing to our family?" You know, my brother had been talking to me about that for years. "What are you doing to this family?" You know, my brother drank, loved to drink. He was a bartender. He's been a bartender my whole life, but not like me. You know, he's one of those guys that could kind of drink, and he liked to get drunk. He'd even get out of control once in a while. But he had values, you know, and I just didn't have any ever. And so he was kind of responsible about it. But I was always the one that was getting the attention from people. And so my dad kind of smacked me in the face, and it just, I couldn't take what I was doing to him anymore, to anyone. And I had lost all hope of having a normal life at this point. I mean, I remember one time I walked out of this club in Baltimore, and I was sober. Stark raving sober, you know. I mean, it was probably 5 a.m. So I walked up to this gas station. It's barely daylight, and I got like a Pepsi because that was probably my breakfast at the time, you know, a bottle of soda, and I had no money. And this guy came in and he got a cup of coffee and a newspaper, and paid for his gas and left, which actually isn't unusual in gas stations. That happens every day, many times a day sometimes. And but it was alien to me. I remember looking at this guy in a suit and tie, like I'm dressed up tonight, he was dressed up to go to work or whatever, and thinking, "Dude, you're never going to be there." You know, and it wasn't like, I wasn't thinking like, "I'm never going to be a sucker like that." I knew I was the sucker, you know. I was like, "You're never going to have a regular job to go to, you know. You're never going to get out of this trap that you've gotten yourself into, you know. And that wasn't the day I got sober, and it wasn't an awakening. That was just the way it was. I was hopeless. I was a hopeless alcoholic. And so when my dad kind of knocked some sense into me that day, I, you know, something stirred in me, because it hadn't been fun for a long time, you know. And yet, the first time I got drunk was probably about 3 years before that day, you know. And so it didn't take that long for me. I went inside and I asked my mom to put me in treatment, you know, put me away somewhere, you know. And they were like, no problem. There was no like, do you think you have a problem, or are you sure? You know, it was like, you know, you're gone. And I went in there wanting to be sober. And yet 3 days later, I'm on the phone with my mom, you know, explaining why it's going to be okay for me to hang out with my old friend that I'd always drunk and gotten high with, as long as I stayed sober. And that she owed me that, right? That's where I was. And just so justified. And part of me believed that. But looking back, I know there was a voice in my head, I remember it, that just knew I was setting myself up to take a drink. That's all. I was just convincing myself that one day it would be okay for me to take a drink. You know, and because I had tried that before. I had made resolutions to stay sober and then would just find myself, you know, totally messed up in the back of somebody's car. How did this happen? I was supposed to stay sober. You know, and so that's what happened. I grabbed the cutest girl in the treatment center that was willing to come with me, and ran out a week after checking in, and I broke out, and I convinced all the kids that I was going to buy cigarettes, and then I was going to come back, so give me all your money, and they actually did. So I had all these kids, you know, cigarette money from the treatment center, and I ran out, and of course I bought a pack of cigarettes, and of course I smoked one. And the next thing I did was I walked over to the payphone. This is BC before cell phones, and called everyone I could call until I found someone to come pick me up. My friend, I've got Christine. I don't even remember her name. Picked me up and took me over to my friend Shannon Ashley's house, and of course, you know, we got loaded. And the second I felt that sense of relief, it brought with it what I'd been getting for probably over a year at that point, which was that guilt, you know, and that feeling like, this is all my headset. You can't even stay sober for 1 week. You can't even make it a week in rehab. Even my friend said to me, didn't you check yourself into rehab? And I said, yeah. And he was like, but now you're here with us. And I was like, that's right, yeah. And he said, you're dumb, dude. And I was like, shut up, you're here with me, you know? And, I mean, it was like, that you couldn't convince another alcoholic that it was logical, you know? And if you can't get over on another alcoholic, you know, you're in trouble. And so, of course, I got hit with that guilt and remorse, and it brought with it something new, which was this fear, you know? Because I didn't know how to stay sober. I thought rehab was going to be the answer, but now I knew even that wouldn't work. You know, I'd never given AA a chance. I'd been to like one meeting where I kind of laughed at everybody and thought that I was different, but I really had no idea how I was going to do this. And so of course I started crying and snotting and really depressing everyone, and I asked them to take me back to rehab, and they gladly did. They were like, no problem, you know, And so 6 hours later, I was banging on the doors of the same facility that I had just broken out of, you know. And I was in that, you know, the big book talks about the bewildered one, you know. And if you're banging on the same doors of the rehab that you just left 6 hours before, bewildered, you know, that's a good word for it. And that's where I was, you know. I want to stay sober, but yet I was struck with these terrible compulsions to go out again. And that's what happened. My dad picked me up from rehab that night. They kicked me out. And I just remember him coming to pick me up and that look in his face, you know. I mean, here's a guy who has always been there for me my whole life, you know. Taught me how to ride a bike when I was a little kid, you know. Played baseball with me, taught me how to, you know, hit a baseball, taught me how to play catch when I was like 7 and 8, you know. I had that kind of dad. active in my life, you know, loved me. And I'm sure when he was holding on the back of that seat when I was riding that bike, he wasn't thinking, man, I really hope I pick my kid up from rehab in 10 years at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know. And it's funny, you know, his birthday just passed a couple of weeks ago, and last Saturday we went out to dinner, and we were at this diner in Baltimore, and I was telling him, I was like, sometimes I mention you when I tell my story, you know, and I told him about that, and he was like, yeah, that was a shitty night.
he didn't, oh, that's okay, that was years ago.
He remembers it, you know, and so do I. I'll never forget it, because that was the night I hit my bottom, you know. I never wanted to see that look in my dad's face again, and it wasn't the first time I'd seen it. But I was working with this new guy recently, and he started talking to me about his bottom, and he reminded me of the sensation that I had, which I haven't forgot, but it's so fresh when you're working with someone who's new. And this is what he said to me. He said he had the feeling of, not tomorrow, not next week, not 2 weeks from now, this is over right now, I'm done. And those are his words, and those were my words when I was new. You know, all of a sudden it wasn't when I get this together or when I get that together, it was, this is done. And the next day I walked a 5-minute walk from where I'd grown up my whole life to the AA clubhouse that I'd grown up practically next door to, you know. And that's where my sobriety started. It's not my sobriety date. A couple of months later, I ended up taking a drink. I didn't think I was taking a drink. I had a sip of a girl's drink that I was dating, who was a non-alcoholic, and she could drink normally. And I didn't end up getting drunk that night, thank God. But when you people talk to me about, you know, going out and relapsing, I thought, well, if I get drunk, I will. But I just didn't have the respect for alcohol that I have today. And so I ended up having to change my sobriety date. And I'm thankful that when I took that drink, I didn't know what I was doing, because I may not be here. But that's what it was like for me in the beginning. I was really, really thick. And luckily, I got a good sponsor. And the first sponsor I ever had, you know, didn't open up the big book and say, we're going to start here at the, you know, doctor's opinion and then walk through this chapter or that chapter. It was nothing like that. The first sponsor I had for the first probably 3 months I was sober taught me how to play spades, you know, and how to hang out. And you know, took me to the diner and bought me coffee, and he'd buy me cigarettes or he'd give me some of his cigarettes and got me hooked up. And initially, the only relief that I got from my head was in the meetings. And in the fellowship, you know. I can remember the first time I ever felt real peace in my heart was at a camp out when I was new, you know, going on a camp out for the weekend and being in nature with other people that were in the program. And it was one of the first memories I have of really feeling comfortable in AA, really feeling, you know, really what I drank for, you know. And so eventually, after a few months, I got a sponsor that would take me through the steps, because it was obvious that's what you do here, is you go through the steps, and I wanted to be a part of, and that's pretty much, I wasn't thinking in terms of getting better or anything. The only thing that I knew was that I felt dirty and disgusting about a lot of the stuff that I'd done in my drinking, and before my drinking, and in my life, and I wanted to get that stuff off my chest. I had a lot of skeletons in my closet, you know, and some of it ended up not being a big deal at all. It was just stuff that had rattled around in my brain and had no other committee except for my own thinking, you know, for 3 or 4 or 5 years, you know. And so there was plenty of inventory that I wanted to get out to somebody. That was really the only thing that held interest for me in the steps. You know, but within that first year that I was sober, I got a home group. I learned about service commitments. I had a bunch of them. And I found a sponsor that walked me through the steps to the best of his ability, and I worked him to the best of my ability at the time. It wasn't perfect, and in looking back, a lot of it wasn't exactly the way it says to do in the book, but the spirit of it was what it says to do in the book. And of course, you know, over the years, I've gone back through that book and made sure that that my foundation is secure. You know, but in the beginning, you know, most of my focus was in going to meetings and sharing and sounding good. And I love to sound good in meetings. I love to share in meetings. In fact, I went to a lot of discussion meetings, and I still go to a good number, but I would put my hand up in any discussion meeting I went to. Any one, any topic, any step, any tradition I know, you know, calling me, you know. And then sometimes people would kind of look around my hand, and I'd be like, you know. And I thought, I had the idea that working the steps meant being able to share on a step, you know. So I'd walk into a meeting, and the topic would be the fourth step, and so I would just think of my fourth step monologue and put my hand up and share and entertain everyone for 7 minutes. And God forbid you would come up to me after a meeting and say, I really got a lot out of what you said about the fourth step in that meeting. You have a lot of insight for a guy your age, because I was 17 when I got sober. I would just think of every word that I had just said and repeat that for the next 5 years of my sobriety. Like, that's what I'm going to say about the fourth step. Because I wanted to be liked, you know. And I had sponsors that always told me how wonderful I was, you know. And that I was their prodigy or their golden child or, you know, how good I was doing. And I had one sponsor tell me all the time, you do more than me. I don't know why you're so crazy, you know. And he couldn't help me, you know. And so I found myself in a place when I had about 5 years sober. The fellowship that had grown up around me in my first 5 years started to break apart as a result of personalities over principles and some genuinely sad things that happened. One of my closest friends hung himself with almost 5 years sober, untreated alcoholism, alcoholic death without taking a drink. And that kind of sent some earthquakes and ripples throughout the people that I had been hanging out with. And at the same time, I was just, you know, had just gotten out of the military and tripled my salary and had an apartment full of unassembled IKEA furniture that I thought was really going to make me happy. A big apartment, good job, and I felt totally dead on the inside, totally empty. New town, I had just moved to Washington, D.C. or the D.C. area and was going to meetings, and I just felt terribly uncomfortable around everybody. And I'd go to these meetings. The Midtown group is a group I was going to. It's my home group today. And I'd go, and everyone would just be so happy and alive, and they were having fun, and there were people my age, and there were people that had gotten sober, but even younger than me. I mean, I'd gotten sober at 17, and it's like, you know, you're almost a little crusty in my group if you wait till you're 17 to get sober, for Christ's sakes. You know, David got sober in his mid-20s. It's like a grandpa there, you know. You know, you meet people that, you know, they're younger than you and they've got more time than you, and that'll piss you off if you're an egotist like I was. And I was in a place where I wanted what these people had, but I mean, I just walk into a meeting and just feel my ears would be bright red, and I wasn't sharing or talking, or I just had no reason to be so nervous except that I was so egotistical and self-centered and thought that I knew something. And you know, and so I got into this place where I started seeing a therapist. A lot of people in AA see therapists. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. On our third visit, he told me that I was going to have to be on an antidepressant medication for the rest of my life for my depression. And that might be true for some people, but I don't have clinical depression. I have self-centered depression, you know. I'm depressed because I think about myself all the time and pretty much nothing else ever. And I went to our Thursday night meeting, choir. It's a great meeting. My sponsor, wasn't my sponsor at the time, but this guy Jack was up there speaking, and he was telling his story, and he said that some people might need to take that stuff, but that he is an alcoholic. He suffers from alcoholism. And AA is the only medicine he's ever needed. And that was soon after my diagnosis of needing to be on something for the rest of my life. So I walked up to that guy, and I asked him for help. Because I knew in my heart from his story, and I knew that he had been where I was, but he wasn't there anymore. And it says it in how it works. You hear it at every meeting, pretty much. You know, if you want what we have, and you're willing to do, you know, and you know you're willing to do what it takes, you know, and that's what I wanted. I wanted Jack's sobriety, and I started calling him, and he started making plans to hang out with me, and then all of a sudden that group that was so invasive and you know, snobby and all the judgments I'd had, I had a couple of Pigeon Brothers, other guys that Jack sponsored, and they'd call me, and we'd hang out, and in my group, if you have more time sober, you sit in the front seat, you know. So if Dave and I were in a car and somebody else was driving, you know, I would sit in the front seat because I have more sobriety than David, which is kind of good when you got 13 years. At the time, I had five, and these guys that Jack sponsored had more time than me, or less time than me. You know, like 2-3 years less than me. And they'd sit in the front seat and put me in the back. And I'd say, what the hell? I got sober in 95, you got sober in 98. Why am I in the back seat smelling your cigarette smoke? And they would look back. Your Baltimore time doesn't count. You know, and I'd be like, that's bullshit. You know, and so I was constantly complaining. And that's, Jack was really nice to me for like 3 or 4 months. You know, and then something happened. One day, I just said the wrong thing, and I remember what it was. And he said, "You probably should have called me before you did that." Well, I didn't really think to do that, Jack. And he just said, "All right," and hung up on me. And then he went out of town for 3 days and didn't return my phone calls. And I was like, "What the hell is with this guy?" You know, he must be having a bad day until it kept happening. You know, and I went through, you know, probably 6 or 9 months, probably about 9 months of AA, you know, sponsor Nazi boot camp, you know, and it wasn't fun. And all of a sudden I wasn't the golden boy, you know, all of a sudden I wasn't a prodigy of service. I was getting hung up on, and I was getting cussed out in meetings. I was getting cussed out in public in front of like other people, you know. And a lot of us go to the beach in the summer every weekend, you know, we're at the beach, pretty much the whole group would go at that time, so there'd be 150 beach chairs just kind of lined up, you know, on 59th Street in Ocean City, Maryland, and my sponsor would tear my ass right in the middle of everybody, right in front of everybody, and I'm like, Jack, we're just at the beach, you know what I mean, like, what's the big deal? And I remember one time he really laid into me, you know, it wasn't like, we weren't talking about any principles or steps or anything, so I thought it wasn't really fair that he was giving me such a hard time. And I thought, how am I going to get this guy on my side, you know? And I got desperate. And so I said, Jack, I got to tell you something. And he said, yeah, what is it? You know, what's going on? I said, lately I've been thinking about killing myself. And he said, I understand. I think you should do it. And I was like... I kind of intuitively knew that's not what you're supposed to say, you know. I felt like I was looking for a safe place to go, and he didn't give it me one. He said, all you think about is yourself. If I were you, I'd want to kill myself, too. You have my permission, you know. And I was like, shit, you know, nothing works. And eventually I did a fourth and a fifth step with him, and I took my time. It took me a few months, and for some reason, there was a breakthrough when I did those steps with him. And he knew my whole life story. He knew my whole story. He knew about the resentments I had towards him for the way he talked to me. He knew about the judgments I had about his sponsor for the way that he talked to me, the one time that his sponsor had talked to me at that point. It wasn't good. And I remember I met my sponsor, the first time I ever met him. His name was Mike. He had a lot of sobriety, and he was very comfortable, very easygoing. And he said, how long, he was tall, how long you been sober, kid? And I said, 5 years. How long you been sober? And he said, long enough to be calm, you know. Name went right down on my resentment list, you know. And and so I disclosed everything. And there was a shift, not in him, but there was a shift in me, you know, that day. And somebody even saw it at my home group. We drove from the beach back to my home group on Sunday, and somebody looked, they said, something's different about you. You seem better. And I said, well, I did a fifth step today with my sponsor. And they said, that was it. That's it. You know, and what happened was this tyrant who had been, you know, just terrorizing my life for months and months, I had kind of realized that all that time he was in my corner, you know. He wasn't having fun with me or deflating my ego because it was building his ego, which is what I had kind of thought at the time. You know, he was making me small enough to stay in AA, and I was very close to leaving, you know. And I would love to stand up here and tell you that ever since then I've stayed small, you know, or that my feelings hadn't been hurt since then when he's you know, talk to me. And the truth is most of the time I don't get that treatment anymore because I've changed. Something inside of me has changed. But once in a while, my sponsor still has the ability to tell me something I don't want to hear, you know, or to give it to me in a way that I feel like, well, you could have spared my feelings a little on that, Jack, you know, and to, you know, to piss me off, in other words, you know. And it still happens to me. I'm still egotistical, in fact, maybe a little more so because I've been sober a little longer now and I feel like I have a place here, you know, and I feel like I have opinions here, you know. But I'm fortunate to have a sponsor who doesn't respect my opinions, you know. He just tells me things the way he sees it. And I'm grateful for that, you know. And once I started to be sponsored in that way where his thinking I saw as more clear than my own thinking, I started to feel really comfortable in that group. And I started to want to do whatever I could for my home group. And so, you know, the next couple of years, right up until today actually, I've tried to do what I can for my group, you know. And it's a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun in my home group, you know. It started out by helping to plan a whitewater rafting trip, which was something that I like to do that I had done with my group that I was a member of in Baltimore. And so I started to put that together and, you know, make the reservations and book the camping facility and all that stuff and sign people up and take their money. It's not easy to do with alcoholics, but I managed it. And you know, and I just remember showing up that weekend after planning and working on this thing for 3 or 4 months and really getting that sense of being a part of something. And it wasn't an egotistical pleasure like all that IKEA furniture or the job that was giving me that paycheck I liked. It was more like I did my part to set up, you know, that weekend and the layout for that weekend to take place, but I knew that it was the people in AA that made it rich, you know, and that it was a higher power working through all of us. And there was some kind of spirit, just like I'd gotten when I was new in sobriety at that camp out, that sense of belonging. Now I was giving that to someone. And the first time I'd gone on that whitewater rafting trip, I had 5 months when I was new, and I didn't have any money. You know, every dollar I got was going to cigarettes, every cent, you know, and it wasn't much. And the people in my group at the time, my sponsor and his sponsor, reached out to me and they said, "We know you don't have any money, but we're going to take you anyway," you know. And I just remember how good it felt to be included. And that's the message that I was given when I was a newcomer. It doesn't matter if you don't have any money. We're going to make sure that you are a part of what we're doing if you're willing and interested. And so that first year that I helped plan that trip, and every year since then, we set a little money aside for the newcomer, you know. And now I get to go up to these guys and say, it doesn't matter that you don't have any money. God damn, I'm such a baby. You know? It doesn't matter that you can't afford it. We want you to come, you know. That is so the opposite of what my life was like before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because with my friends, the second you turned your back, I was taking what I could out of your bag, you know? And the second I turned my back, you were getting whatever you could get. And that's what it was like. And it isn't like that today. I've been taught differently, you know? Not mentally, not in my head, not intellectually. My heart has been taught differently, you know, and so I started out helping out with events and making coffee and doing stuff like that, and eventually when I started listening to a sponsor, I started to be able to sponsor other guys, started to be able to help other people, you know, and started taking other people through the big book and through the steps, and as much as I talk about Jack sponsoring me, helping me, reaching out to me, guiding me, and how important that is, and how important that is today. The truth is, I get a lot more out of sponsoring other people, you know. And when I first heard my sponsor say that, it sounded like sacrilege. Like, the number one thing is I have to respect my sponsor because I have to stay small enough to stay here, and I have to follow direction, you know. But the honest to God truth is, I do need those things. I do need a higher power, I need a sponsor, and I need my group. But what I get more out of than anything else is passing this thing on to the best of my ability. And sometimes it's not that great, you know. And in my sobriety, personally, you know, a lot of people talk about how as they've gone through the steps and as they've gotten better and stayed sober here, they've gotten really comfortable. There's a certain level of serenity where people just rise to this point where their problems don't really bother them anymore, and they feel pretty emotionally balanced all the time. And that's not my story at all, you know. I'm still a crazy person, you know. And it's not that the steps haven't made me more comfortable, because they have. It's that I don't work them every day, you know. I mean, there are days when I wake up and my head's just like, rah, 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 you know, I mean, it's just, it's crazy up there, you know. And I'm just calling every newcomer I know, you know, to help me, to get me out of it, to pull me out of it. And there have been a lot of guys that I've seen more comfortable than me, happier than me, in a better place than me, walk out the door and take a drink. And I don't know why that is. And I'm not advocating for emotional instability. That's just my story. You know what I mean? I just am kind of neurotic and insecure and uncomfortable, you know, generally, naturally, you know. And I'm not proud of it, but it's the truth. And so I've asked myself, especially over the last year, you know, my sponsor said to me recently, a lot of people went out and drank in 2008, and that's true. In my group, we had a lot of losses. We had a couple of people go out with over 10 years, and that'll get my attention, you know, because I've got over 10 years. Friends of mine. And so I've asked myself, what is it in me that's kept me here, you know? And the only thing that I can attribute, other than the fact that obviously I have a higher power in my life and I pray, is that every time I've had a rough patch in my sobriety, and there have been a lot of them, you know, relationships don't go my way, resentments towards my sponsor, you know, anything, you know, having to show up for work every day, just like everybody else. For some reason, I've always run to AA, you know, and I don't know what that is. And a lot of people, they run the other direction, and I don't know why that is, but I'm so grateful that with any problem I'm given, I bring my problems to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I find a solution there. I don't think the solution's in the bottle, and I'm grateful for that, and thank you.